Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2009, today's guest, Sarah Short, her partner Shane Bauer, and their friend Josh Fatal were hiking along the Iraq-Iran border. After an armed man in uniform waved them over, their lives were forever changed. The Iranian government held Sarah Short for 410 days in solitary confinement as a political hostage from 2009 to 2010. She was in Tehran's most notorious prison. Since then, Sarah has become a nationally known critic of the overuse of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. After being freed, driven by a need to understand what happened to her own mind, she traveled to 13 prisons across the United States, interviewing people living in isolation units. And she weaves their stories into The Box. It's a new play in San Francisco about prisoners in isolation. A typical solitary confinement cell is about the size of a compact parking space. Confinement cells are often sealed shut by metal doors with only a slot for meals to come through and for communicating with prison staff. Prisoners in isolation are typically on their own for 22 to 24 hours every day, virtually free of human contact. An estimated 80,000 to 100,000 people in state prisons were held in some form of solitary confinement in 2014. And sometimes they are in there for decades. There are more people in solitary confinement in the United States than any other country in the world per capita. The Box examines the slow psychological violence rooted in the practice of isolating prisoners. Sarah Short drew on her own personal experience and interviews with prisoners and their families to write this play. I saw it over the weekend, and I really hope you can. It's an incredible play. It runs from Wednesday through Sundays through July 30th, and every Wednesday showing, including tonight's showing, is followed by a discussion on mass incarceration. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org or zspace.org. And Sarah Short joins us in studio to talk about her new play and her personal experience. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for coming in.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Congratulations on the play. I am still thinking about the incredible acting and the stories. Really, really well done.
Thank you.
So thank you so much. So this is such a personal story for you and a very personal journey. Why did you decide, after being held for 410 days in Iran, to dive so deeply into this issue?
Well, I mean, I think in many ways I question free will. I'd question it being a decision. I think it's just sort of a part of the path that I've been on, part of my own trajectory as a person. It came from first a need to understand what had happened to me. A lot of things that happen to you in long-term isolation are shameful to talk about. Naming your own body parts, having an emotional connection to an insect, hallucinations. I screamed and I beat at the walls of my cell. It helped to hear that this happened to other people. A lot of people, when I first came out too, looked at me and said, oh, you look great, you look amazing, it's all over. You hold those scars very deep. And it's important. It was important for me to unearth them and to connect it to something larger than myself.
How many hours a day were you in your cell?
23 hours a day. They take you out to a slightly larger cell. It's the same system here. In U.S. prisons, they call it the dog run. It's a larger cell with high walls and an open ceiling with bars. And in Iran, they called it havalkhori, which means to eat fresh air.
And talk a little bit about coping mechanisms, because that was the other thing too. That was the other thing that was interesting to read about, is how when you interviewed prisoners across the country, you were able really to relate to the way that they also coped.
Yeah, definitely. I think that one of the things that I related to a lot is people sort of finding something larger than themselves to pour their pain into, so that your own suffering doesn't seem meaningless. Trying to create some kind of meaning. And you have to change your story. You have to change something really essential about what it means to be human, or find something really essential. And in the early months, I said, I can't do this. I thought I would be broken by it. And I thought I'd never be myself and that I would lose myself. And then I decided, no, other people have done this. There's got to be a way. And somehow I can come out of this with some kind of knowledge or insight that maybe can help others.
Can you talk about what being in solitary confinement does to your brain? In interviews, you have said that it attacks your frontal lobe. This is the part of your brain that helps you make good decisions. And people have no skills on how to deal with their anger other than through violence. And then being in solitary makes them even more violent.
Exactly. It can have that effect. Different people are so, you know, varied. People react differently depending on their sort of predisposition, what they go in with. I went in speaking three languages, so I spent a lot of time speaking in three different languages, practicing yoga, meditation. I had skills and resources to draw from. Some people don't have much of anything to do other than feel emotions they've never felt before and have no skills to deal with. So people can go into extreme depression, they can get lethargic. I mean, I had periods where I didn't move or eat for days, and other periods where I was in a rage. And so I think that, yes, it affects people differently, but one thing that we see a lot is just after 2 or 3 days, the brain slows down and gets lethargic. People have a hard time concentrating. A lot of people say they stop reading, or they stop, even if you're able to communicate by shouting down the hall with other prisoners or passing notes. A lot of people, after a long time in solitary confinement, just lose interest in social interaction. So antisocial people are being put in a situation that makes them more antisocial.
And it's so interesting because these are things that we don't really spend much time talking about. You write that you can be in a cell next to the same person for a decade or two decades and hear them, hear their toilet flush, hear noises, and never see their face.
Exactly. A lot of times when people hear the term solitary confinement, they picture total isolation, like being alone on an island somewhere. There is a kind of unbearable intimacy to these solitary confinement pods. They're a lot like mental asylums. 40% of the people that go into them go in with mental illness and have no business being in prison in the first place. They should be treated. Instead, they're put in conditions. One judge in California said, putting a mentally ill person in solitary confinement is like putting an asthmatic in a room with no air. So they quickly decompensate. Many other people go in without mental illness, but of course come out with mental illness.
And suicide in solitary is twice as high as in the rest of the prison population in the United States.
Yes.
We'll talk about Kalief Browder later in the show. He was at Rikers, a young man, and he committed suicide. So talk a little bit about the journey you took in visiting 13 prisons across the country. How difficult is it to meet people who are in solitary confinement in the United States?
Well, that varies a lot state to state. The most trouble I got was in California in trying to visit the people I was writing at Pelican Bay. Several times my applications were lost, quote unquote, in the mail, and I just had to keep trying. And of course, getting to Pelican Bay it's an 18-hour drive sneaking through redwood forests.
Way up north.
Way up north, yeah, along the coast near Oregon. And a lot of other states, it was no problem at all as far as getting approved. But a prison I went to in New Jersey, Edna Mahan, I had to take a train from New York City, and then I got to this tiny town, and there was one taxi in the whole town, and he took me to the hotel, and I decided I was going to walk because I saw on my phone, okay, it's only half a mile from here. I was walking through the snowstorm with a deer all around me, and a car pulled over and looked at me like I was insane to be. He's like, do you realize you're near prison? And I was like, that's where I'm going. But to be able to go into that prison, and that in particular instant, I'd been writing that person for about 6 months, and she told me a joke and made me laugh. And it was always amazing to me, overwhelming, that kind of humanity. And these are flawed people that have made mistakes and have had really difficult lives, but they haven't given up, you know, on life. She told me that joke, and that joke eventually was integrated into the play. And that's the kind of journey some of these jokes and anecdotes and stories have had, where now 5,000 people in San Francisco are going to be able to laugh at her joke.
This was a woman?
She was a woman, yeah.
You don't hear much about women in solitary.
You don't. I mean, yeah, many women are subjected to it. It's not at the same percentage as men. But women are often put in solitary confinement for really horrific reasons. like to protect them from after they've been raped by a guard or another inmate. So there's this kind of solitary confinement called protective custody, where you put someone who is LGBTQ, the victim of a crime, and in solitary confinement to protect them from others. Of course, there's no pretense to as far as protecting them from themselves or what happens to them when they get there.
You say that in some cases people are put in solitary because the guard didn't like how the prisoner looked at him or her. You also say in some cases they might have a bag of chips and they weren't allowed to eat that and they're put in solitary. What other reasons?
Well, this is why the practice is meted out in a completely arbitrary fashion. The whole process is internal. This is a sentence on top of a sentence. It's a prison within a prison. So when you commit a crime in our society, you have some sort of due process. You go to court, you have a lawyer, maybe you even have a jury. None of that happens inside. Inside, it's a kangaroo court. From everything that I've heard, 99.9% of people that have a trial end up getting sent to the hole. It almost always sides with the officer, the CO. So if a guard doesn't like you because of your political beliefs, if a guard doesn't like you because of the way you look at them, they can always find something to put on you, whether it's a little bit of extra contraband in your cell. Plenty of prisoners have extra contraband in their cells. So this is really at the discretion of the guards, whoever they want to get rid of, whoever they want to disappear, whoever they want to punish.
So to talk a little bit about the process involved in trying to get interviews with prisoners and what happened when you were at the prison. Were you able to bring in a tape recorder? Were you able to take notes with a pen and pad?
No. When you're visiting, I was visiting as a friend, not as a journalist.
As a friend, okay.
Yeah, so I'd been writing these people intensively, corresponding with them over the period of 6 months, and I tried to visit everyone I corresponded with. And they put me on their list, so, yeah, you can't bring anything in. I'd sit afterwards on a bus bench or in my car, if I had my car, and just scribble everything down I could remember for, you know, for an hour or so afterwards. So that's one of the reasons why I found that it was important it was more honest to fictionalize this, to create a fictionalized piece, because even though I did very deep investigation and worked on this for years and years, it was all filtered through me as an artist, through my memory, through my own experience, and through, you know, really what I wanted to say with this piece.
Did you tell the people you met that you were working on a play?
Yes. Yeah. From the beginning, I asked them if they wanted to be participants, and I said that it would be an intensive letter correspondence, and at the end of that, I couldn't promise that I could continue the correspondences, because it's very difficult for a lot of prisoners to get this kind of attention and then lose it. Mm. And I said, at the end, you can read the play, and if you want to be named as a contributor, I'll very happily name you as a contributor.
And almost all of them agreed to that.
Almost all of them, yes.
Except one, I think, right?
Exactly.
And so what was there – I don't like to say was there a theme, but when you talk to them about what they wanted the outside world to know about their experience, what really stands out for you?
Well, I think that people – I mean, the people that I ended up interviewing are the ones that had a certain level of resiliency and were able to cope because they'd been in for a long time. A lot of people that can't cope really do commit suicide, or they go, you know, they lose their minds and they're not able to correspond, you know, intensively or participate in a project like this. So I had to rely on the people that I interviewed to sort of represent the stories of the others that could not. And again, I think that resiliency comes from either being able to maintain a relationship on the outside with a family member, or having something that a sort of catalyst, something that focuses your time and gives you direction. So for some people, it's reading, study. For others, it's writing. There's some incredible writers inside. A lot of their stories made it into the anthology that I co-edited with my colleagues at Solitary Watch, which also came out recently. It's called Hell is a Very Small Place. For some people, it's religion. It's a belief system. For a lot of people, it's resistance. I mean, my play is about people coming together inside a solitary confinement pod across race, across, the insurmountable barriers between them. Because of, you know, the nature of their conditions, and deciding to fight back, to resist their conditions. And that was inspired by the historic California hunger strike that happened here 5 years ago.
And that involved four prisoners from rival gangs who came together in California, and it took off so quickly across the state.
Exactly. Over 30,000 people, prisoners across the state, went without food, some of them for up to 60 days.
Wow.
It was the largest hunger strike in history.
Are people still talking about that, and what has come of that?
It was the beginning of the ripple effects are still being seen. First, they decided to stop because the governor agreed to do a hearing, and there were several hearings in Sacramento, and then a historic settlement happened in the case California versus Governor Brown, Ashker versus Governor Brown, and that has resulted in over 1,000 people getting out of solitary confinement. They're people that have been in solitary confinement in the state for over 10 years.
Wow.
They're now on the main line. Now, this is a huge, huge success, legally speaking, and absolutely incredible for these people to get out. It's clear that they didn't actually think they were such a threat if now they're able to release them onto the main line. The concern is that those cells are still there and that they'll be filled with new people, fresh off the streets, younger people.
When you say mainline, it means back into the prison population?
The general prison population.
Do the people who are released from solitary get any help, or are they just released back into the mainline, and do they have to fend for themselves?
I have heard that in some cases there's a sort of temporary, when you're transferred out of Pelican Bay into another facility somewhere in California, there's a period where you're still in isolation to sort of get you ready to go onto the main line. But as far as I haven't heard of any kind of services, no.
Today we're speaking with Sarah Shord about her new play, The Box. It is based on interviews she conducted with prisoners in isolation at 13 prisons across the country. Sarah spent 410 days in solitary confinement as a political hostage in Iran from 2009 to 2010. So this is a very personal play for her. The Box runs from Wednesday through Sundays through July 30th. Every Wednesday showing, including tonight, is followed by a discussion on mass incarceration. Find ticket information at yourcallradio.org or zspace.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you know someone who experienced solitary confinement, if you have any personal experience with this, we'd love to hear from you. If you work on these issues, what have you seen? What changes have you seen? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. I don't want to give that much away about the play, but right when you walk in the door, it's kind of jarring because you hear so much noise.
Mm-hmm.
And at first I thought the actors were just getting ready.
Mm.
And then I realized that we are in a prison, right? And so then when you take your seat, you're watching six people in their cells.
Mm.
And I guess what really got me was the consistent noise and the yelling and the chaos and the guards slamming their batons against the cells. It was never quiet.
No. And obviously, I mean, we had to tone it down quite a bit in order to make it just bearable for our audience. And also harnessing the power of theater to get people to be able to experience the storyline and not be totally distracted by the chaos and mayhem. We used actual sound recorded inside an isolation pod given to us clandestinely. And the soundscape is just incredible. I think that a lot of this play challenges people's conception of what solitary confinement is. We imagine you can hear a pin drop, that you are somehow on a desert island, but they're not. They're in the middle of something like a mental institution, but without any treatment or any services. A lot of solitary confinement pods, the door is bars, so you can actually shout at people next to you and carry on conversations. You can be celled next to someone for years, even decades, and never see their face. Others have a solid door but with a food slot, and they can shout at each other through the food slot, sometimes communicate through a vent. I could also communicate through a vent when I was held in Iranian prison or shout down the hall when the more lax guard was working. They come up with ways to pass notes. In many ways, when people ask me how I survived, and it was because I found a way to maintain some kind of connection to the outside world and to other human beings. And I found that again and again here, that people, no matter what restrictions you put on them, it's what people do. They find a way to reach out and say good morning to someone else, to ask them how they're doing.
I still think about one of the characters in your play, and the acting is just incredible. This character, Looney Tunes, is played by Jay Jaw, and he doesn't really say much, but he's consistently moving and pulling his hair and screaming. And then because he's screaming, the other prisoners are telling him to shut up. So they're making him angry. And this really illustrates the way that solitary can chip away at your humanity and your sanity. Can you tell us more about Looney Tunes?
Yeah, Looney Tunes is... he represents the 40% of people that are mentally ill, that are put in because they're mentally ill, because there's no way to deal with mentally ill people in our prisons. And, I mean, this is really, his performance just blows me away every time. He stays in character every second.
Every second. How does he do this for six plays in a row from Wednesday through Sunday?
That I don't know. I'm incredibly grateful to him and all of these actors for, it's really more than acting. I mean, they're living it. They're immersing themselves in it. And there have been times for me as a survivor in this position where I'm asking other people to subject themselves. I mean, this is not solitary confinement. They can leave at any time. This is a choice and this is art. And all of them have their own stories that they've brought to these roles that have made them more realistic, more alive, more complex. All of them are motivated by something, you know, a real need to shine a light on this practice. But at times when I first saw the actual set and I saw the lights in the cells, when I was in prison in Iran, the lights were never turned off. So I had to sleep. So for 410 days, I never saw darkness. And I had to sleep with something tied around my eyes. So when I saw those lights in the cell, I just thought, I can't do this to them. That was my first thought. And I had to leave the room. And, you know, I've checked in with all of them, and they're doing this. They're very excited about this project. So it was more about me finding that boundary and, you know, letting them rise to this.
The Guardian has a piece about a study involving interviews with people held in housing units at Pelican Bay, and it found that confinement induces a psychiatric disorder characterized by hypersensitivity to external hallucinations, panic attacks, obsessive thinking, paranoia. Psychological assessments of men in confinement at Pelican Bay indicated higher rates of anxiety, obsessive rumination, violent fantasies, nightmares, trouble sleeping. I mean, the list just goes on. And no rehabilitation that you're aware of.
No. One of the things that I think because there's a sort of narrative out there from prison officials that we have still to some degree bought into, that this is necessary, that there's no alternative. I get asked that question all the time when I speak all around the country. What's the alternative to solitary confinement? And, there are many, many better ways to run a prison. Solitary confinement was used in England for a brief period of time. They started to use it more and more frequently, and they have an outside body that can come into the prison unannounced and keep track of violence, all kinds of, you know, how many assaults are happening in a prison. And they saw right away that as the use of solitary confinement increased, violence in the overall prison went up. So the way to have violence in prison go down is to give people a way to constructively use their time, to give them anything, any kind of rehabilitation, any kind of services, bring violence down. Solitary confinement does the absolute opposite. It's a control mechanism that we've come to rely on in our prisons because of mass incarceration, because we're warehousing far too many people than are possible to warehouse in a humane way. So instead of treating them, rehabilitating them, we are basically just putting them, warehousing them in the most inhumane conditions possible, and then dumping them on society.
Today we're speaking with Sarah Shord about her new play, The Box. It looks at the slow psychological violence rooted in the practice of isolating prisoners. It's based on interviews she did with prisoners across the country living in isolation. It runs from Wednesday through Sundays through July 30th. Find ticket information at yourcallradio.org or zspace.org. Sarah is also co-editor of the book Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in today's conversation on Your Call. You may call us on the telephone. You may send us an email. You may go to yourcallradio.org website, or you can tweet us. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you may call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. The website is yourcallradio.org, and our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Coming up in a half hour, it's the BBC's World to Have Your Say. David Cameron is out. Theresa May is in as the new UK Prime Minister. That's the big topic of conversation on BBC's World Have Your Say, 1/2 hour from now here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Winona Howder about her new book, Fracopoly, The Battle for the Future of Energy and the Environment. She investigates how the fracking industry began, and she argues that deregulation under Bill Clinton, Wall Street, and the oil and gas industry have worked hand in hand to promote fracking. So tomorrow, we will take your calls and questions about fracking, and then Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we will be having an entire show about police violence and the recent police shootings. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today I'm joined by Sarah Shord. She's out with an incredible new play called The Box. It looks at the slow psychological violence rooted in the practice of isolating prisoners. Between 80,000 and 100,000 people in state prisons are held in some form of solitary confinement here in the United States. We've got more people in solitary than any other country in the world per capita. And prisoners in isolation are on their own for 22 to 24 hours a day, virtually free of human contact. And Sarah has very personal experience with this. She spent 410 days in solitary confinement as a political hostage from 2009 to 2010 in Tehran's most notorious prison. I really hope you can see this play. It runs from Wednesdays through Sundays through July 30th. Ticket information is at yourcallradio.org or zspace.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any personal experience with solitary confinement, or if you have questions for Sarah, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us, @yourcallradio. And let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Sarah, for your contribution and what I can't believe you went through. I just wondered, I'm an attorney and I have a small practice in Berkeley, and, you know, I'm also just a citizen. What do you think that people can do on the outside, if anything, you know, to help support people both in solitary confinement and also when they get out, to get some kind of help?
Thank you. Well, I think that one thing you can do is writing letters or visiting people in prison. And a lot of people think of that as sort of it's a drop in the bucket. I mean, people feel helpless in addressing the whole system of mass incarceration, and I understand that. Writing a letter can not only be a lifeline for someone in solitary confinement, but it also lends transparency to our prisons. If people didn't correspond with prisoners in California, have relationships with them, visit them, the California hunger strike would never have happened. It never would have been possible, and all of the changes that are still coming from that historic event. Everything that this movement has done against mass incarceration, we're starting to see results. I think the story around who ends up in solitary confinement and why has shifted because of all of this work. So I just encourage people to think about what they do and how that connects to prison. For everyone, it's something different.
And if you go to the play, be sure to walk into the cell that's in the lobby area, and you can actually write a postcard to a prisoner.
Yeah, yeah, which is incredible. I mean, when I received the few letters that I received in prison would completely change my mood. I would be dancing around my cell, laughing with joy. I would memorize every word. I mean, it really, you can't emphasize what it means to people.
Wow. When you visited prisoners in 13 prisons across the country, I'm sure everybody has different stories about letters they receive, if they receive family visits, if they have contact with their families.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Most visits in solitary, actually all of them that I know of, are no contact unless they're in a cage. Some of the people that I met with, you know, visually it's horrifying to see someone literally in a cage, although a solitary confinement cell is just a cage. But at least you can shake their hands. You know, at least you can make eye contact without glass and give them food from the vending machines. So visits they intentionally put people in places very far away from their families and try to cut off their ties with their families, which of course makes it much less likely that they're going to be successful when they get out.
Right. Well, thank you for calling in, Robert. Let's go next to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. It's Sarah, right?
Yes.
You wrote the book? My brother was in solitary confinement for many years in Missouri. And the lights were on 24/7. He thought he was going to go crazy, and so he started writing poetry. And then eventually he got out of solitary confinement and immersed himself in computer science. He had he did not graduate from high school, but he was very bright. And he wrote the manual that, I don't know if they still use, but he taught himself about computers, and he wrote the computer science manual for the prison. And he's one of those rare stories. He'd been in and out of prisons from his early days until he was in his 30s, and he just made some decision that he didn't want to go back. However, he was sort of institutionalized by the time he got out, and he did marry someone. However, he didn't like people. He kind of reconstructed his solitary confinement in his house. He lived in what I used to laughingly call the bunker. He had many, many computers in this room in the basement, and he stayed in there almost all the time.
Wow.
And he interacted with his wife, and he and I had telephone calls almost every day. And I wrote to him when he was in prison. But I'm curious to know, if I wanted to write to a prisoner, how would I go about doing that?
Great question. Well, Solitary Watch is a great resource. You can find their website online. And there are many organizations, American Friends Service Committee here in San Francisco, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children. You can also come to the play and start by writing a postcard. We are sending postcards to people in solitary confinement. And if they write back, we're giving them a P.O. box, and we will forward the letter to you.
Mary, did your brother get any help after he got out?
No.
None?
None.
Wow.
It wasn't offered, and he wasn't the kind of person to seek it. Mm. You know, he was the kind of person as I can do it myself.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing his story, and thank you for calling in.
Could I ask you where your play is playing? Because
Yes, it's at Z-Space in San Francisco in the Mission. So you can go to zspace.org. You can also go to a play called
TheBox.com. TheBox.com. Thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, Mary. I hope you can see this play. So again, it runs from Wednesday through Sundays through July 30th, Z-Space in the Mission. And on Wednesdays, including tonight's performance, it'll be followed by a discussion on mass incarceration. And are the actors also involved in the discussion?
Yeah, many of them.
Oh, wow. I cannot say this enough. The acting is really incredible. So thank you again for calling, Mary. Let's go next to Charlie in San Francisco. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I also have a solo show called A Solitary Man, My Visit to Pelican Bay State Prison. And I've worked with men there who also have been transferred, and I've seen the change that they've gone through as they've gone out. I also wanted to talk about some of the resources that are available. There's an organization called Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition that formed to support the hunger strike in 2011 that's still ongoing. And there's also the Prisoner, the Human Rights Pen Pal Project that matches prisoners, especially at Pelican Bay, with people who'd like to be pen pals. And you can, the website is prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com. And the pen pal project, you could Google Human Rights Pen Pal Project. And there are many prisoners that would love to hear from people. And it's a very, like Sarah's saying, it's a very rewarding experience, and you learn a lot from them, and it gives them a link to the outside, which is so important for them.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in, Charlie. Today we are speaking with Sarah Shord about her new play, The Box, which examines the slow psychological violence rooted in the practice of isolating prisoners. There are more people in solitary in the U.S. than any other country in the world per capita. We're talking 80,000 to 100,000 people. They're on their own for 22 to 24 hours a day, virtually free of human contact. Sarah, earlier in the show, you said that women are in solitary, which I've hardly ever read about that. And sadly, because of the case of Kalief Browder, we also learned that youth are in solitary. Mm-hmm. How common does that happen?
It's still legal in California, shockingly. Wow. I've been working with Senator Leno on a new bill, SB 124, which hopefully will pass this year, that will ban the use of solitary confinement for juveniles. For juveniles, their frontal lobe is not fully formed, so this is even more likely to cause permanent brain damage.
We've done a lot of shows about these issues, and one of our guests, Frankie Guzman, who was in and out of prison since he was a teenager, told us that guards would put the entire unit on lockdown, and they weren't technically in an isolation pod or the hole, but they were stuck in their cells for 23 hours a day. And there's also the story I mentioned, Kalief Browder, 16. He spent 3 years on Rikers, never convicted of a crime. He was charged with stealing a backpack, right? Mm. And so while he was awaiting trial for robbery, he says he did not steal this backpack. He was in solitary for 2 years. And The New Yorker broke this story, and a news story just came out last week and said that he learned how to commit suicide while he was in solitary.
Mm-hmm.
He attempted suicide in solitary, was unsuccessful, but he was successful when he got out.
Mm-hmm. The incredible thing for me when I honor Kalief, and he's one of the people that the play is dedicated to, is that he came out and he talked about his experience. That takes incredible bravery. Some of the interviews that he did and the way that he was able to articulate what had happened to him helped so many people and was a catalyst for change in New York that is still, you know, spreading. So I definitely honor his memory. And there's a character in the play that's very, in some ways, similar to him.
Now that this is receiving more attention and you have this bill with Mark Leno, a lot of people say we need to just get rid of this practice altogether. I mean, is that the ultimate goal here?
I think that in some very extreme circumstances, segregating someone, a prisoner, from the rest of the population for a very limited period of time, a number of days. The UN Special Rapporteur says 2 weeks at the very maximum. After 2 weeks, should be subject to very stringent reviews. I'm not trying to whitewash the fact that there are extremely violent predators inside our prison system. The play doesn't in any way gloss that over. The actual characters that are in many ways heroes, incredibly resilient human beings, have done horrible things that sometimes they're ashamed of. Sometimes they've never really been given the chance to atone for the harm they've done to others because they themselves have been relentlessly victimized by the system. I think that violence is an epidemic in our society. I mean, look at the mass shootings, look at police brutality, police murders of innocent black and brown men, unarmed. We need to address violence in a real way, not deny the fact that we live in a very violent society. People are afraid for good reason, but locking people up in conditions that dehumanize them is in no way going to make us any safer.
How did you address this issue in the play? Because you made a decision to do a fictionalized piece based on the interviews you did in 13 prisons across the country. Another character in your play that I still think about, Victor Santiago, played by Carlos Aguirre?
Aguirre,
thank you. We actually were just talking on Facebook, and I asked him, how do you do this six times in a row? And he said, you know, I'd love to call in, but I have to save my voice
exactly.
for the show
yeah.
tonight. But Victor, if I remember correctly, in the play, was in a gang, and he was convicted of murder. And you follow him throughout the play as he tries to heal his relationship with his daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, Carlos is such a just completely profoundly in this character. He himself is a father, and I think he brings a lot of his you know personal experience to this role. The idea that he could ever be separated from his daughter terrifies him, and his Victor is a complex character. Maybe we don't know the entire backstory, but I think we've all heard it in one version or another, where you grow up in a neighborhood where gangs are the way that you can have some kind of status, some kind of power, also protection. And it's the same thing inside prisons. It's even more extreme. If you don't join a gang, who's going to have your back? And that often leads to participating in some kind of violence. And does that mean that this person doesn't deserve a second chance, that we're going to throw them away, that we're going to completely give up on them? I hope that Victor himself in the play goes through a sort of transformation where I won't give it all away, but in the beginning he's really just out for himself. And even his relationship with his daughter is all about what can she do for me. And that really shifts when he starts to connect himself to a political struggle and see that he's actually being subjected to something that that is much larger than himself.
And why did you decide to do a fictionalized piece?
Well, first and foremost, to protect my contributors, and also to give, because I wouldn't want any kind of, there could be retaliation inside prisons. I wouldn't want their families or friends to see something that a character says and hold them accountable for that, the real life people that are living this or have lived it. Also, I think it gave them a certain amount of freedom to share intimate details and things about their lives, thoughts, and feelings without being worried that it could be traced back to them. As a writer, it allowed me to draw upon my own experience as a survivor of solitary confinement and to filter these stories through that experience and through all of the many voices, many stories that I have gathered, and elevate them to something universal, something that I think someone who has no connection to prison, doesn't know anyone who's ever been to prison, can relate to. It's about how much we need each other, about how the relationships in our lives, that really who we are as individuals, how we get meaning is all through relationships to other people, to ideas, to movements. So I think that really being able to touch upon those larger themes was part of the reason to fictionalize.
And The Box runs from Wednesdays through Sundays through July 30th, and it's at Z Space in the Mission in San Francisco. And on Wednesday nights, if you can go on Wednesday, including tonight, the play will be followed by a discussion on mass incarceration. Find ticket information at yourcallradio.org or zspace.org. And we have just a couple more minutes if you'd like to call in, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. And let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Let me turn this off. I wanted to let listeners know about a wonderful resource right here that you can pick up for free all around San Francisco. And it's called The Bay View. It's the national black newspaper. And they have unrelenting month after month coverage of this issue with articles from prisoners who, and many of the prisoners are the politicized prisoners who are becoming a force for change in California, in Texas, in Georgia, in all over the country. And also, at the end of each article like that, you have an address to write to that prisoner, and there are also pen pal resources in the newspaper. It's just a wonderful resource for information about solitary and a force for changing it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Judy, and we will link to that right after the show. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Hello. A question or a comment, I guess. Gosh, you know, I do this to you all the time. My radio's on. Do you want me to run and turn it down?
It's fine, Greg. You sound fine.
Thank you. Just a question or a comment and then a question. One is, you know, being in prison and warfare, which this country does pretty well, are the extremes of the on a spectrum of violence. I just remembered reading just the other day a book by R.D. Lang called The Politics of Experience. I went back to it, in which he makes a statement, which I think is really true, that we're all so damaged because of the widespread violence perpetrated on us from the time we're born by the institutions that we live in. And that's my feeling about this society. Those extreme forms are just a more extreme manifestation of the everyday violence that people have to live with, whether it's poverty, homelessness, you name it. I mean, it's there, and that's all I could say, and I don't know if she has a comment on that or not.
Well, I very much agree. I'm not sure that I have anything to add. I think you said it really well.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Greg. I was just listening to a show this morning about UC students who don't have enough food. And I was thinking about these very issues, and I think we can do a show about this and at least just open the lines and talk about it. So thank you for calling in. Let's go next to Denise in the East Bay. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a hopeful forecast on this topic. I work on prison litigation projects throughout the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and my task is really to train judges to educate them about the difficulties inmates encounter when they're incarcerated. And we had a correction summit in the Ninth Circuit in November. We brought together correctional officials and plaintiff's counsel. We had former inmates participating and then judges. And the idea was to collaborate on better practices. We did a whole presentation on segregated housing and eliminating the use of it. And so I feel like there's a real sea change going on, and the nice thing about having a play that deals with it, it gives the artistic perspective, which is an experiential way to teach, you know, judges and attorneys about the issues. We did have a play called Mariposa and the Saint that was about a woman in solitary confinement, and I think the comments that came back from people is they felt like they learned about solitary confinement in a way they would never have been able to experience it by watching this play. So your play will have a great effect, I think, and that you'll see a ripple occur as a result of portraying it in this way. So thank you for your work, and I wanted to let you know there are some positive things happening in terms of collaborative efforts across all the stakeholders in the prisoner litigation area.
Well, thank you for calling, Denise. We're getting a lot of emails with a number of organizations. David writes, please tell the lawyer who called in from Berkeley to join the prison project of the National Lawyers Guild. Sharon says the box is very powerful. If you would like to write to a prisoner who is active in the hunger strike, email humanrightspenpals@humanrightspenpals.org. Thank you for that, Sharon. And what are your thoughts, Sarah, just in terms of what you want people to walk away with after seeing this play and learning about the realities of solitary confinement?
Mm. Well, I want them to walk away with a different story about who the people are that end up in the deep end of our system and why. And I think that you begin to unravel the whole system. I think that the storytelling plays a really important role because we've had this story for a very long time that somehow our prisons make us safer, somehow they serve us. And storytelling, we're talking about the way solitary confinement affects the brain in such a negative way. Storytelling actually affects the part of your brain, the same part of your brain that is affected by lived experience. So when you're engrossed in a story, something is visceral and all-encompassing. You're literally walking in people's shoes for those 2 hours. And I think that changes the choices people make. I think it changes their action in the world.
And what about change? What sort of change would you like to see? I mean, we just got a tweet about prison abolition. But what would you like to see?
Well, I mean, I agree that our prisons need to be revamped from the bottom up because they're not serving us in any way. I'm not a prison abolitionist per se because I myself have been the victim of violence from individuals and government. And I think that there are times when we do need to separate people from the population when they're a danger to the rest of us. But punishing them without in any way rehabilitating them doesn't serve anyone. I think that there is right now some momentum, and I think that if everyone contributes in their own way, we can keep this momentum going. But it's always a sort of two steps forward, one step back struggle. As soon as you gain something, you have to push harder because that can so easily be lost. It's a very resilient structure, the prison industrial complex, and they find ways to punish people. And of course, my fear is, hey, if we were successful in banning solitary confinement, what are they going to try next? There's no point to me in banning solitary confinement if it's not at the same time injecting the prison with a shift towards rehabilitation. And I think that, in theory, if you take away solitary confinement, if you take that tool away where you can just disappear someone, you have to rehabilitate them. You have to deal with them. So it could force that change.
The Box, Sarah Short's new play, runs from Wednesdays through Sundays through July 30th at Z Space in the Mission. Every Wednesday showing, including tonight's, is followed by a discussion on mass incarceration. Find ticket information at yourcallradio.org or zspace.org. Sarah Short was held in solitary confinement for 410 days as a political hostage from 2009 to 2010 in Tehran's most notorious prison. Sarah, thank you so much for your work. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Winona Howder, author of the new book, Frackopoly. She investigates how the fracking industry began, and she argues that deregulation policies under Bill Clinton, Wall Street, and the oil and gas industry have worked hand in hand to promote fracking. So what do you want to know about fracking? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.